Yes. Okay. So today we're going to be talking about the role of intellectual in politics in the modern era. And in particular, we're going to focus on this book I told you about by Charles Kurtzman, a political scientist from the University of North Carolina, called Democracy Denied, which is about a whole bunch of pro-democracy revolutions that took place in the first decade of the 20th century in quite disparate places around the world. But nevertheless, what they had in common was they were led by intellectuals. Okay, and they all failed. And most of them in a relatively short period of time, actually, like within a couple of years. Okay, This development is actually very historically significant. I mean, I think one of the things that Kurtzman says early on about the significance of this is that it actually involved a quarter of the world's population. If you add up the populations of all the countries that were involved, so we're talking about China and Russia, we're talking about the Ottoman Empire, we're talking about Iran, and Portugal and Mexico. Okay? So that's a quarter of the world's population at the beginning of the 20th century where there were these revolutions that took place that were led by intellectuals. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is I don't know how many of you knew that. And I don't know how many people, let's say, among my colleagues would know this, that in the sense that there was this kind of moment, as it were. Okay? And in a way, that's kind of an interesting thing in its own right, because this was the moment where intellectuals could arguably, and in fact were very self-conscious about promoting themselves as a political class of potentially geopolitical significance. Right? So in other words, this was a moment where intellectuals were kind of putting themselves at the same level as the bourgeoisie, the landowners, the working class. They were actually identifying themselves as a class, and as you know from this book, if you read the book, you see that the various people involved in these pro-democracy movements were in contact with each other across national boundaries, and of course were in contact with the intellectuals and the great powers, right? So where we're talking the great powers of that period, of course, is Britain, France, Germany, and the United States, perhaps. He thinks it is. Perhaps it's a borderline case. The other borderline case would be Japan. Okay, especially after the defeat of China in the war in 1895, which in a way brings China into this picture, okay? So there is this kind of moment, right? Now, one of the things, of course, that's very interesting if you look at the history of how intellectuals were thought about in the 20th century, so in the, let's say, the period after all this stuff is taking place, I think, generally speaking, from the standpoint of, you know, are intellectuals any good at politics? You put the question like that. I think the general answer would be no, they're rubbish. Right? I mean, I think that's kind of, you know, of course, I'm giving you the tabloid answer. You know, one would say, of course, we have to be sort of sophisticated in our answer. But the general line of thinking goes in that direction. But see, it didn't seem that way in the first decade of the 20th century. Okay? So what I would say is a few things about, first of all, where did this intellectual class come from, this whole idea of intellectuals? And how is it able to spread as much as it did, and why did it fail, right? And then that brings us into Kurtzman's stuff, and whether there are lessons there, because Kurtzman, at the end of the book, wants to talk about things that have been happening in the post-Cold War period, or at least in the last quarter of the 20th century, so from 75 onward, that in a way revisits some of these kinds of things, where there are intellectuals involved in modernization of a lot of these countries, and other countries as well, of course. And of course, the Eastern Bloc gets sort of thrown in there more directly, the former Soviet countries. Okay, so the first thing about intellectuals. I think, it, you know, to really understand this idea, you have to go back to this business of ideology, okay, which is, of course, a word that Marxists use, but really kind of comes into its own in the late 18th century as part of how the French Revolution gets explained. Okay, so there's a sense in which, if you want to give a history of intellectuals, the French Revolution is a very convenient political point, because whatever else one wants to say about the French Revolution, whether it was good or bad, it's quite clear that the Enlightenment philosophers, the ideas of the Enlightenment philosophers at least, were very much involved in motivating the people to do it. Now, the French Revolution these days is normally portrayed as kind of a middle-class tax revolt style revolution, in a way, somewhat more violent and all-encompassing than what actually took place in America about 15 years earlier. Because the American Revolution was clearly a tax-based revolution. Basically, middle-class people feeling they're being overtaxed and not represented in Parliament, and so they're demanding representation in Parliament. The British are not giving it to them. They want to really treat Americans as second-class citizens, as real colonists, and that leads to the revolution. Okay, that's the American Revolution. Now, the French Revolution, for a long time, was portrayed as a sort of working-class revolution. But this is not really the case if you actually look at how it actually worked, because it basically involved quite a lot of organization, and it really doesn't get taken, it really doesn't take off until it is widely known that the treasury, that the royal treasury is squandering all of the tax money that is being brought into the country, so that the middle class is increasingly subsidizing the monarchy in France, which is fighting a lot of senseless wars and kind of getting into all kinds of trouble, and basically bad for the economy in general. Now, how do they know this? Of course, this has a lot to do with the rise of a kind of free press that takes place in the 18th century across Europe. Okay, and so there's publicity about this, right? But it's, all, of course, only publicity to people who know how to read. And again, we're talking about a relatively small group of people, and these are the people who would have paid attention to the Enlightenment. Okay, and these are wealthy bourgeois people. Very often, these people, while they were literate and actually quite well-read, they were outside of the normal higher education channels, which were typically dominated by the church. So if you were not a particularly spiritual or religious person, you really were not inclined to go to university, which was seen as basically a place where you trained priests and bureaucrats. And so you get this independent class of people arising who are reading and so forth, and they're getting their own views and everything. And the Enlightenment is very much about thinking for yourself. Now, these people don't have the right to vote or anything. Okay, that's another point, right? So there is no obvious medium of political expression in France if you actually are having these misgivings about the way in which the economy is being run. Okay? So all that's very important as background information about the French Revolution. Also, the main project of the Enlightenment was this thing called the Encyclopedia. You may have heard of it. This is the thing that Rousseau, Voltaire, Diderot, Montesquieu, all these great Enlightenment guys contribute to. Multi-volume thing is kind of the foundation of the sort of thing we nowadays call encyclopedias. So the Encyclopedia Britannica is invented, 15 years after what these French guys did. Okay? And the thing about that reference work was, first of all, you bought it on subscription. So in other words, it was the kind of thing, just like the way in which you, throughout the 20th century, people bought encyclopedias that way too. Namely, you know, you pay for it on a monthly basis and on an installment basis. So again, it was for the kind of middle-class person with disposable income. It wasn't something being taught in schools. It wasn't mandated by the church or anything. It was this kind of independent channel of providing information that gave an alternative picture of what was going on in the society. Okay? And of course, throughout the 18th century, there was a lot of tension and conflict because of the kinds of things written there. And, you know, people like Voltaire in particular wrote these very satirical dramas and stuff and was always getting into controversies with, you know, religious leaders and things like this. And this caused them a certain amount of discontent. So these guys were very often on the move. They were, especially they didn't, you know, go off to the Netherlands or Switzerland, which are kind of safe havens, right? Or sometimes England. Voltaire spent some time in England. So this is what the 18th century is like. Now, the French Revolution comes out of this, right? And it's basically, and this is where the idea of an ideology comes in. The whole idea that by having a certain way of thinking about the world, that in itself empowers you to change things. Right? So in other words, what's the motive force? It's the ideas. Right? So if you read the books and you start thinking for yourself, there'll come a point where you just get these ideas and these ideas will motivate you. Now, the interesting thing about this, and this is where the origin of ideology is not just the name of a certain set of beliefs, you know, like whatever, you know, religion, Marxism, whatever. No, it's also a certain theory about how action happens in the world. And it's through ideas. Okay? Now, Marx is going to contest this, right? But I do think it's important to see what this looks like in its, opening move. because it was a view, you know, because we nowadays often think of ideology in a very negative way, right? Ideology is false consciousness. Ideology is those beliefs that other people have, which leads them to be deceived about how the world works, right? That's kind of Marxist kind of view about ideology, kind of a negative view of ideology, right? And ideology is often counterposed to science in this context, right? Ideology versus science. You probably too young to remember this, but when I was a kid, right, everybody was crazy about this French Marxist, Althusser. I don't know if anybody even reads him anymore, but for a while, he was an important figure. I mean, he's now part of the dustbin of history, actually. I don't think anyone in this part of the world, unless they show, put it this way, people who still take Althusser seriously show their age. I think that's, you know, he's kind of, but he was the one in the 1960s and 70s who really made a big, this, you know, science, ideology. Marxism is science, ideology is what everybody else believes. And he was real hardcore. I was recently, I don't know if you people watch continental European cinema, I do, and I was recently watching some of the old stuff from the 60s, Jean-Luc Godard, and it was amazing how in so many of his films, Althusser's name would pop up. You know, unusual. And these are films where everybody's kind of moody and existential and doing weird things, right? And Althusser's name would pop up, okay? But that's kind of, as it were, what ideology became. It became the opposite of science, right? That's kind of what it, and I think people still get that kind of negative sense of ideology. But in the late 18th century, it was a very positive term, and it was basically about people opening their minds and realizing the potential that they have within themselves to do things. Right, so when Kant, towards the end of the Enlightenment, writes about, you know, Kant is the guy who names the Enlightenment, right? And he names it toward the end of the 18th century. So in other words, the Enlightenment's almost over by the time he names it. The motto of the Enlightenment for Kant is dare to know. And what that means is that you do not take for granted what the authorities believe, the church, whatever, right? You think through things for yourself. And the point here was that by thinking through things for yourself, using your own reason, that was itself an empowering thing. You know, the truth shall set you free, this kind of mentality. Now again, I don't know, maybe you find this all very trivial, very obvious, I'm not sure exactly how you think about these kinds of things today, but those were very radical ideas in the 18th century, where people, you know, back in those days were pretty much used to accepting beliefs off the shelf, as it were, right? In other words, somebody tells you what to believe, and you believe it. And this had a lot to do with the fact that people weren't reading source material firsthand, right? So in other words, people weren't reading. They had no other, they didn't have multiple channels to find out stuff. They just basically listened to the authority. And I think, you know, where this is really important is, of course, in religious matters, because this is where the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century begins. This process of enlightenment. Because Protestant Reformation made a big deal that if you're a Christian, you have to decide to believe for yourself. You cannot, as it were, inherit Christianity. You know how it is in a Catholic church where you baptize the kids when they're a few months old. The kids have no choice in the matter. They're just kind of born Catholics, right? Now, you know, if the idea is that you're supposed to be choosing Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, then you have to be conscious enough to do that, which means that you shouldn't have to be baptized at such an early age. It should only be once you've read the Bible, kind of understood what the Christian view of the world is, and then choose. That was what the Protestants were always about that kind of thing. But what that meant is you had to read the Bible for yourself. And oh boy, that started trouble. Because of course, you read the Bible for yourself, and everybody reads something different. And the way Catholicism was able to hold itself together was basically by not stressing that people had to read the Bible. Well, what do you have to do to be a good Catholic? Go to church every Sunday, you know, bow and worship and sing a few songs, you know, but, you know, you don't have to actually read or even understand. And, of course, the stuff was written in, you know, the Bible would be written in Latin or something, and the ordinary people didn't know Latin. Okay, so the point here is, once people do start to read the stuff for themselves, then all sorts of possibilities for dissent open up. And see, the Enlightenment contributes to this. The Enlightenment pushes us to the next stage. Okay? And indeed, a lot of the Enlightenment guys, if you look at people like Voltaire and Rousseau and all these people, they were originally trained in, like, you know, Calvinist schools or Jesuit schools. In other words, they have the Christian background, and then they just push it to the next stage. Right? But the idea here is that you have to confront the materials for yourself, and then you get ideas for yourself, and the ideas empower you. So that was what ideology was about. And it's when you get that, and you get the ideologues, as they call it in French, right? Ideologues, right? The people who were promoting this, right? These were the people who were behind the French Revolution. Because if you look at the French Revolution, right, it's all about liberty, equality, and fraternity, right? That's the, you know, the slogans, that's what people are pushing. It's a revolution about ideas. Okay? And this kind of notion of, as it were, leading the revolution intellectually, as it were, is one that crops up again when, in the examples that Kurtzman's talking about. The guy, Madero, who's the kind of the friend, the Mexican revolutionary, one of the things that he says at one point, which is very much in the mold of what I'm talking about here, let me see, I've just to get it, got the little quote from him, right? He tells the people, this is something so here's Madero, right? He's this intellectual telling the Mexicans at the beginning of the 20th century, you don't want bread, you want the freedom to earn your bread. That's what you're fighting for. You're not fighting for to get bread, you're fighting for your freedom to get bread. Okay? Now you see, this is very characteristic, right? Where, as it were, the actual material needs, and this is very characteristic of the way these intellectual revolutions work, is that people aren't being promised very hardcore material things, like you're going to be fed, you're going to get a job, when we get into office, we're going to, you know, kind of make life easy for you. No, what you're doing is you're giving people an idea that they should find valuable because it will open all kinds of possibilities for them, which they then will have to do for themselves. So it's all about enlightening and empowering people. Now, of course, this could have quite diabolical consequences, right? Because what are people going to do with this freedom? And this is part of the story, right, about why these revolutions failed. But I think the calling card of these revolutions, intellectual revolutions, is that what you're fighting for is freedom, not for bread, but for freedom. Okay? And so this is the kind of thing that we're talking about that we get with the French Revolution. We get this kind of thing, you might call it a certain style of political rhetoric, which of course is still very much with us today, right? Whenever people are fighting for civil rights and stuff like that, and human rights, you know, that rhetoric is, ideological rhetoric is very strong still. Okay? And that was what was going on there. But the problem was that the middle classes, what they basically did was, they organized the working class, and they basically had the working class, you know, peasants often, who were being stirred up. So in a way, it was a very kind of top-down sort of revolution, except that one couldn't control the peasants afterwards. And it's a problem that recurs again with these kind of intellectually-based revolutions. Namely, the workers start to actually take this idea of freedom seriously, and they don't feel as though that it's gone far enough. So once the intellectuals overturn the monarchy or overturn the dictator, and they've got some kind of control over the government, the working class say, hey, don't stop there. Bring us into it. Okay? And in fact, this situation becomes more a problem as you move into the 19th and 20th centuries, because you're getting a larger percentage of working class people learning how to read. Okay, and that is kind of the tricky part about intellectuals. In a way, it's one of the reasons why the intellectual class was both able to become a kind of global class by the beginning of the 20th century, but at the same time was kind of doomed to failure. Because you see, what you had, what supported all this was the fact that you were getting actually large numbers of people beginning, certainly learning how to read and write, but also going to university and things like that. And they were coming from many different backgrounds of society. So you were getting kind of a critical mass of people. But you really couldn't control what those people would then do with what they know and what they learn and so forth. And so it was a bit like herding cats, you know, where in a sense, you know, people moving in all many different directions. And people are never satisfied with the pace of progress. Okay? And this was an issue that was very... by the way, Lenin's way of handling it, because Lenin, you know, he's in the sidelines watching all the stuff going on in Russia in 1905. And he's not getting involved. He's just going to let this run its course because he figures this is doomed, okay? He kind of knows that. But what he does, Lenin's strategy, as far as the issue I'm talking about here, is basically to always position the party, which is the vanguard, right? I mean, Lenin makes a big point of saying the Communist Party is a vanguard party. It is ahead of everybody. The party is always ahead of everybody. So in other words, you do not lose the momentum. Because the problem with these intellectuals, whether they try to get a certain point of stabilized government that is no longer authoritarian, but is some kind of parliamentary democracy, but then the workers want to move it further still. They want redistribution of land and redistribution of income, and they want it now. You see, all they're trying to push all that stuff. And the intellectuals just can't move so fast. So the intellectuals find themselves in a position of playing rear guard. They become all of a sudden the establishment that has to be overturned. And that often leads to a lot of them collapsing. Okay? Whereas Lenin's solution was to say, we're always ahead of everybody. And one of the ways in which you can sort of demonstrate that the party is ahead of everybody is that everybody suffers equally. You just keep on putting the pressure on everybody. Right, so you put the pressure on the middle class, but you put the pressure on the working class too. And everybody's got to push. The workers, just by themselves, are not leading the pack. The party is leading, and the party stands for everyone. Okay? So you have to make this argument, and this is where the Marxist salvation story is so important here. You have to see it as a historical quest, right? In other words, it isn't just simply a matter of if you overthrow the autocrat and then you establish a parliamentary government, then in a sense our basic problems will be over and we can then just do things in a sort of normal Western way. No, you have to say that this is actually going to take generations to do or decades to do and that we're all going to have to struggle. And this is kind of the Marxist picture. And perhaps there's like enemies within who we have to keep on fighting. Okay? But you put the pressure across the board. Right? But whatever you do not let one class suddenly jump in there and say, we're actually ahead of the game. So you don't let the working class, as it were, just do its own thing and start to undermine what you're doing. Okay? Now, there's a lot of ways of doing this, by the way. And Lenin, again, you know, the stage management of this is brilliant. Because, you know, who is this guy Lenin? Lenin's an intellectual, of course. Lenin is very much like the sort of people who, in fact, failed in that revolution in Russia in 1905. But the difference is that Lenin, along with Trotsky and some of these other guys who are studying what's going on, they stage manage things. So, see, one of the problems with the intellectuals was that the intellectuals, in a way, always appeared intellectual. Right? So they're middle class people, basically, right? Just, you know, they're a certain kind of middle class person, typically intellectual. They sort of look intellectual, you know, they wear ties and glasses. And, you know, this kind of look from the turn of the century, right? With little beards, and, you know, things like this, and look a bit precious, right? They don't look working class, do they? And so one of the things that Lenin and Trotsky and a lot of these early Soviet guys figured out was you've got to start to play the part. You know, if you're going to speak for the working class, if you're going to lead them, you have to dress like them, you have to look like them, you have to act like them in various ways. Even if that is a certain amount of showmanship, you nevertheless have to do that so, as it were, you can enact your identification with the working class. Because the problem with the intellectuals, you know, when you have an ideologue say, you know, we believe it's unfair that all the property and all the money is concentrated in a few people, and we are going to redistribute wealth and everything, but you're still wearing your cravat, you know, you still have your glasses on, you still look, you know, pretty high up there. It's not very convincing. Okay? It still looks like there's a certain kind of distance there. And that aspect of the situation, it was one of the things that both made these intellectuals in the early 20th century look very attracted to the global media. Because if you read any of the Kurtzman's book, one of the things that's really striking about these intellectual revolutions is all the newspapers and wire services were covering them. They were, as a media thing, they were beautiful. Because you basically had all these very smart people changing the world. And they looked smart, and they were saying smart things, they were great for sound bites, you know. And so in a way, it really played to that kind of global media thing. But in the end, they were dissociated from the people they were trying to lead, okay? And that's something Lenin learned, okay? Lenin figured that out. And that, of course, became very, very much part of, as it were, you know, the new look of revolution in the 20th century, where you look like the people you're leading. You know, you think of Fidel Castro. That's a great example, right? Fidel Castro, Cuba. That man, you know, lawyer, very intellectual sort of guy. Look at him. He, you know, dresses like an army sergeant What's that about? And he still does. Right? But he's like, he's an intellectual. You see, these intellectuals that Kurtzman talk about would never have dreamt of doing something like that. Okay? So there is this kind of issue here about the sort of stage management. But a lot has to do with the fact that these people, intellectuals, really believe the ideas were the things that mattered. Not the look, not the feel, but the ideas. Okay? You know, it's interesting because, you know, you think about what's going on with Obama now and his problems. Obama has a bit of 1905 to him, I'm afraid. If you know, I mean, he's in a way an intellectual who's trying to actually do all these wonderful things for the masses, but he's detached from them, right? He doesn't connect with them, so you end up getting this Tea Party movement and all these other people, right, who in a way are more like the dispossessed, actually getting a lot of political mileage just by showing how alienated he is from them. Well, this is kind of a bit what happened in 1905 in the end. Okay, so it's not like this issue goes away. It's still very much with us, even in sort of modern democratic politics. So ideology, you know, as this idea of ideas motivating you. I mean, it's interesting. If you're interested in kind of the psychology that was behind the original conception of ideology that the French had in the French Revolution, one guy is to look at is this guy, Maine de Biran. Okay, who was in the early... He was actually one of the... He was... There were several people who came from aristocratic backgrounds during the French Revolution who actually got involved with the revolutionary government. Okay, and this is common as well, right? They sort of crossed over. Maine de Biran was one of them. Though he eventually became disaffected, as a lot of these people did, and because he didn't die and didn't get his head chopped off, he was able to write some books and things. He's very interesting in the history of this because he actually thought a lot about the psychology of what it is for an idea to actually motivate people to do things, given that ideas are very abstract things and stuff like that. Right? If you think about the Enlightenment, the psychology that was promoted during the Enlightenment was one that, on the one hand, had this very strong sense of reason, right? Often based on kind of mathematical notions of reason, deductive reasoning. And also they had empiricism, right? You know, so in other words, the way how the world appears through observation. And so it was very much against superstition and stuff like that. That's kind of the way we normally see the Enlightenment. But Maine de Biran added this other, another aspect to the human psychology that he thought was very important for ideology to work. And this is associated with the idea of will. The will, okay, and this is part of the ideas empowering, right? So in other words, the ideas that we're talking about in ideology are not simply ideas in the Plato sense, right? Plato, you know, ideas, the things you contemplate, right? The perfect forms, right? There's that kind of classical view of an idea, okay? Ideas are acting as motivators. They're sort of getting you worked up. And so the idea, you know, so the business of the will comes into play, where in some sense you act out the idea. So the idea is thought of in a way as kind of a potential that you then bring to realization through your action. Okay? So you're supposed to act out the idea, basically. And this involves will. There's a very interesting, if you read, do you know who Aldous Huxley was? Famous novelist who wrote The Brave New World. An interesting author. He has a collection of essays, the title of which, I forget the collection, but he actually has an excellent essay on Maine de Biran, because he's regarded as kind of an obscure philosopher these days. But very interesting kind of essay about the impact of thinking about things this way. But this was clearly meant to sort of try to make sense of how it was possible for people to start revolutions over ideas. Because you think about most warfare tends to be over fairly material things. So, for example, you know, national borders, land, right? Who's entitled to rule, right? I mean, things like that. But here people are fighting about liberty. Right? What are they doing? Right? Because there's no guarantee that you're going to actually live better as a result of it. Right? That's the interesting thing about these things. There's no guarantee that you're going to get paradise at the end when you're fighting for an idea. Okay? Now, so all of this happens with the French Revolution. And then there's the next generation. And the next generation is reflecting on the French Revolution. And as you know, the French Revolution was a kind of short-lived thing in a way, right? It very quickly became a kind of dictatorship. And then eventually it just collapsed. Napoleon took over. And then you got a kind of monarchy back in place. Okay, so the whole revolutionary potential of the French Revolution seemed to have been dissipated and seemed to have caused an enormous amount of violence and so forth. And so for that first generation after the French Revolution, there was a lot of disappointment among the intellectuals. And some of them became reactionary and went back to the church and all the rest of it. Okay, but one guy who was keen to learn about how we can make things better in the future, learn from the revolution, as it were, was Auguste Comte. Okay? And so, Auguste Comte is born after the revolution, actually. He's born in 1798. He is the person who, in a way, kind of took seriously the idea that, ideas, in a way, rule the world, but not just any old ideas. And the problem that the French Revolution had, and indeed he saw this was a problem that the Enlightenment thinkers had, was that when they spoke about things like freedom, equality, fraternity, these are the three words of the French Revolution, that they did not have a scientific understanding of these things. That these guys were basically still talking metaphysics. And metaphysics is this kind of unholy halfway point for Comte between religion, which he really does. He doesn't like religion in its traditional sense at all. He thinks that's pure superstition, so he shares that view with the Enlightenment people. But, on the other hand, it's not yet scientific either. Because you basically need a plan. It makes no sense to talk about freedom, equality, and fraternity unless you've got a plan. How are you going to implement this? How are you going to restructure society? Okay. So in principle, you see, Comte was not against the kind of move the French Revolution made, which was to go to ground zero, right? Start the calendar at zero, all that kind of symbolic stuff the French Revolution did, which was we got to start from scratch. And then we have to build up, what our government is, what our economy is, what matters, etc. Comte was for that. But the way you were going to do it was going to be through science. You need a scientific way of implementing the ideas. Now, what this meant for Comte was that even though, in a way, the project of realizing that, of realizing this kind of scientifically organized society, is positivism. That was his definition of positivism. So positivism is a political movement, a science-led political movement. Okay? And Marxism is, in a way, a competitor with it. In other words, Marxism is another science-led political movement by its own account. Okay? So the way, and this is one reason why if you read Lenin's works before he becomes, before the Soviet Union happens, Lenin's works are very much in dialogue with positivism. Right? That's the opponent. Right? Because in a sense, and the positivists are, of course, the ones who are behind the 1905 revolution in Russia, the first revolution. And so, this is the way you should think about positivism as the way Auguste Comte was presenting it. Now, Comte worked outside the university structure. He was he was a university-trained person, mathematics originally, but he couldn't get a steady job in the university, and a lot had to do with his kind of somewhat unorthodox religious views. Again, we have that problem there. And so he became sort of the assistant of the person who's normally regarded as the great utopian, so-called utopian socialist, as Marx and Engels called him, in the early 19th century, Henri Saint-Simon. You've probably heard of him, right? Saint-Simon, at least, okay? And so Comte worked for Saint-Simon for a while, and so with Saint-Simon, you really get, in his writings, you get a really kind of social engineering, okay? For the first time, you get that idea. So in other words, we're not just talking about people being motivated by ideas to change the world. So it's not just that, but rather these ideas are being disciplined and structured in such a way that you can actually come up with a blueprint for reorganizing society. So it's a very disciplined sense of ideology here, okay? And this is what Saint-Simon was all about, and Kant picked this up, right? And in fact, if you Saint-Simon wrote a very interesting pamphlet after the fall of Napoleon. Okay, so Napoleon, if you remember, Napoleon wanted to unify Europe, basically, right? He wanted a kind of secular version of the Holy Roman Empire. That was his goal. He didn't succeed, okay? He got exiled. So everything, you know, Treaty of Vienna, end of Napoleon, you know, people go back to their reactionary regimes and all the rest. But Saint-Simon is sitting there thinking, well, maybe we can do kind of what Napoleon did, but do it scientifically. And so he has this brochure that is a plan for the reorganization of Europe. And it's kind of the first statement of the kind of thing we think of the European Union as being, in a way, okay? About a kind of economic, or, you know, unit. How do you make that possible? Overcome the kind of barriers of language and culture, which somebody like Saint-Simon and Comte would regard as reactionary. Right? You're right. So from their standpoint, this is the whole positivist mentality, right? All these cultural, linguistic differences and things, these are just, as it were, organized prejudices that have been allowed to develop over the centuries, which are preventing any kind of future social progress from happening. So what you've got to do is you've got to basically unify the culture under science. This is the plan, right? The notes, the reorganization of Europe is like 1814 or something. You know, Napoleon's exiled, right? Just before the Treaty of Vienna. This is Saint-Simon's plan, and Comte's very influenced by this. And Saint-Simon, in addition, you know, in a way, it's so up to date because he talks about knowledge economies, knowledge society, and that the whole mode of production of an efficiently run society will be based on knowledge. And he's imagining kind of rule by expertise. Rule by expertise, right? And this, in fact, becomes very much the calling card of positivism. And in the parts of the world where positivism was incredibly influential, so Latin America would be the, you know, you look at Latin America, just go down from Mexico down, positivism is all over the place. You look at the, have you ever seen that Brazilian flag? The Brazilian flag, okay, I've seen it in soccer games, right? I mean, you got the Brazilian flag there, and it's got this, kind of like that. It's the other way around. This is in the outside, the circle's inside. Okay, well, the thing is that there's a little motto underneath the Brazilian flag called Order and Progress. That was Comte's motto. Comte's motto for the positivist movement was order and progress. And it's in the Brazilian flag still, okay? And so, this was the idea, rule by expertise. Saint-Simon is interesting because the way he presented this, because you think, what's the spirit in which one should take this proposal? Well, he presented it as a kind of model of political economy, okay, in which the state is understood to be run kind of the way in which Adam Smith thought a factory ought to be run, right? So what he does is, Saint-Simon, is he says, okay, you read Adam Smith, and you think of, okay, how do you organize a factory? It's through efficient division of labor, right? And you have people who could do the certain things the best, the other, you just put them there to do it. And then, as it were, the magic of getting the highest level of productivity is from organizing them rationally so that they each play to their strengths and what they're doing connects together to produce this socially useful good. Right? This is kind of Adam Smith's story about, and this is why you want free labor, because you want free labor because you want to be able to figure out in the marketplace figures out who's best at what. And then these people will come together and do something wonderful. And so Saint-Simon's view is the state ought to be thought about this way, and that you have everybody kind of, so you imagine the state as being divided up like a firm, maybe, where you've got certain people working in certain areas and they connect up with other people, and this is all managed from the top through social engineering. Okay, that was his view. In fact, he had a very radical version of this view, much more radical than let's say the social engineering you see in socialism or the welfare state. or fascism for that matter, which also has a similar view. You know, when we talk about, you know, sometimes we talk about fascism as the corporate state, right? The corporate state being, literally speaking, that you treat the state as if it were a body, a single body, and then all the different parts of the society are seen as functions of the body, right? Like the respiratory system, the circulatory system, right? The nervous system, right? And that's how you think of the society, right? The state is this kind of body, living body, social organism, right? This is all from Saint-Simon originally. And of course, you know, fascism makes great hay out of this, of course, as a socialism, okay? So it comes from him. And Saint-Simon was willing to go very far on this because he believed in collective ownership. Collective ownership managed by the elite class of social engineers. So it's not so different from what Lenin ended up with. Okay? And what does that mean, collective ownership? Not just collective ownership of land, right, or money, or resources. And by the way, why collective? Well, because everybody needs to be involved in order for anyone to get anything. Right? So if you actually have this highly integrated view of society, where everybody's working together to produce some kind of common social product, then no matter what you're doing, you're equally valuable. So there's where the collective ownership comes from, okay? So, you know, so in other words, you really take seriously the social organism idea, right? You just can't abstract out one part, then the thing dies. You need it all, right? This is his view. He's very clear about this. And, but he goes very far with it. So it's not only just about money, it's not just about land that in a way is commonly owned, it is our individual bodies. Okay? This is a very important point. He and Comte, and this is the thing that becomes kind of difficult to finesse, is these guys are not friendly to the idea of human rights. Okay? They think human rights are basically theological illusions. Right? So the integrity of the body, the fact that I own my body, which is a very fundamental thing about human dignity and most human rights legislation in the West, right? That is an idea that goes back to theological notions of bodies being ensouled, right? That we each have our individual souls in the sort of Judeo-Christian Islamic world, right? We all have our souls. And so there's an integrity to the body as a result of that. Well, Saint-Simon and Comte just said that's rubbish, that your body is basically like a piece of land, essentially, right? And in a sense, you know, we all own your body. Okay? So, for example, we can force you to eat certain things, you know, take certain kind of exercise, put you in certain kinds of situations, if we think that it's going to enable you to increase your social product. Okay. And there's a sense in which, while your opinion is valuable, to hear about, you know, how your body's doing and everything, oh, it hurts, oh, I feel ill, those are just data points you're giving us. You're not saying anything authoritative about what should be done with yourself. Because that's discerned by the social engineers. Just like the land, just like the money, just like everything else. Okay? So this is really a very strong kind of collective ownership, top-down social engineering view. And the view, and the idea here is that what will make this work? What will make this work is if we get the science right. Right? And so it is still intellectually led, right? So even though we're talking about this massive redistribution, this massive reorganization of everything going on, nevertheless, it's all for the good if we got the science right. If we got the science right. Okay? And so this is where Comte comes in, right? Because if you know about Auguste Comte's work, Comte is primarily known for having this kind of theory of the history of science, right? Where science goes through various stages and then ends up in this, what he calls the positive stage, right? And you know what the positive stage, what is the science at the end of the road, at the positive stage? It's sociology. Sociology, right? Sociology is the science of social engineering. And it is the science that we are working toward, which will take all the insights from all the other sciences, which will have, you know, which developed earlier in history, and put them all together and integrate them for purposes of social engineering. So sociology is going to be the science. And he coins the word sociology for that purpose. Okay? Now, you know, I don't know if you people experience this, but even when I was a student at university 30, 35 years ago, the word sociology was always regarded with a certain amount of suspicion. Not because people thought the subject was stupid or something, which is what people think today, but rather because people thought it was socialism. Right? And sociology was socialism. Now, you know, and the thing is, why did they think that? It wasn't just because the words sound the same, but it's because there is this history. There is this history. Okay? In a sense that the science originally got named as this, you know, kind of the science of this project we've been talking about. A kind of intellectually led scientific reorganization of society. That's what sociology originally was in Auguste Comte's hands. And it was a very tricky thing in the late 19th century to kind of, you might say, you know, let's use this word in English, detoxify, right? I mean, if we talk about toxification when something gets poisoned, right? And in a way, Comte sort of poisoned sociology by describing it, you know, by making it the name of this project. Because when people wanted to distance themselves from this project, right, said, look, I want nothing to do with social engineering. I want nothing to do with all of this reorganization of society stuff. What are they going to do about the word sociology? And so this is where Durkheim is a very important player in this, because Durkheim, Emil Durkheim, who's living at the end of the 19th and early 20th century, is in fact someone who has to kind of detoxify sociology in order for it to be acceptable as a university subject, right? Because the universities are still the places where you're training the next generation of elites in the country as the country is normally understood. Right? It's the establishment, right? You're training the next generation of the establishment. And the problem with positivism in the 19th century was that it was seen as a kind of revolutionary movement. Okay, it didn't necessarily have guns or anything attached to it, but nevertheless, what it was saying in its propaganda was very radical. It was very radical. By the way, you know, the interesting thing about reading somebody like Comte is, see, Comte and Marx are very similar figures in terms of how they come to their conclusions, in that what they really do is they look at history and they first make a judgment about what really matters in history. And then they kind of follow it through and try to figure out a logic in it. You know, just like Marx does in terms of, you know, succession of means of production in society, going from the earliest slave-holding days through feudalism, through capitalism, to socialism, right, looking at it. Well, Comte does the same thing, looking, you know, starting off with astronomy and then moving into physics and chemistry, right, and biology and sociology. He sees a kind of historical thing there, too. And then there he sees a logic going through that, which then justifies the logic, in a way, tells you what you're going to do in the end. Okay, so again, it's belief. You know, in the case of Comte and Marx too, that, as it were, if your ideas are scientifically valid, right, and you've come through the scientific process, that will enable you to implement them, no matter how radical they are. So, what, you know, these stories don't tell you anything about how people are going to react. Right? They don't say, okay, Comte will tell us now, how are people going to react to what you're saying? You know, or Saint-Simon, how are they going to react to this? I mean, one can see how certain elites would find this interesting, perhaps, as a way of ruling. But how are you actually going to get regular people on board with this? And so Comte had an answer to that, too. As you know, he was a big promoter of the religion of humanity. Right, there was this positivist church. In fact, there's positivist churches. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Paris has one. I don't know if you know. Do you know about Comte's calendar of the secular saints? Okay, one of the things that Comte did in creating this positivist religion was he borrowed a lot from the Roman Catholic Church, because the thing that he liked about the Roman Catholic Church, even though he didn't like the content of the doctrine, he liked the way in which the Roman Catholic Church could actually rule diverse groups of people in diverse countries, you know, without having to sort of, you know, constantly be terrorizing them. right? These people, you know, and so his argument was that the thing about religion that was still worth preserving wasn't the doctrine, but was the sense of ritual, you know, and the kind of mystifications that came with the ritual that would enable people to obey. Okay? That was Kant's way of doing it. You know, how do you keep, you know, the working class, how do you keep the non-intellectuals on board? Kant's answer was, you know, you don't become one of the working class. You don't, that's Lenin's way of doing it. You know, you don't try to act as if you're one of them. No, what you do is you create this major distance, like the Catholic Church did. Okay? So one of the ways he did this was he established a calendar of saints. You know how the Roman Catholic, if you know, the Roman Catholic Church is distinctive in Christianity because there's a patron saint for every day. So you go to church, and if you go to church in a day, you'll be told, ah, today is, St. Jude's Day, and St. Jude was a saint because he did some marvelous, miraculous thing, and, you know, we should pray to him so something miraculous happens to us too, right? This is kind of the way I was raised this way. This is how Catholics work. And so Kant would have people, you know, instead of worshiping St. Jude or somebody like that, you know, worship Newton, Galileo. And these were the people who were his saints. And he's got this thing for every day, 365 days. Bacon, Francis Bacon is there, okay, the founder of the scientific method. Hobbes, you know, I mean, all these crazy guys, right? They're there. They're saints that in fact, people should be worshiping. The saints, the great intellectual saints, who are, as it were, the people who are the background to positivism. The great scientists, the great philosophers, who were scientific philosophers, of course, not the superstitious ones. And even has a hierarchy of saints. Catholic Church has a hierarchy of saints, too. And so this was Kant's view about how you would, in fact, be able to rule this way. You would have this kind of religious kind of institutional thing going on. Okay. Now, Kant made a living, basically, as a management consultant. That's what we would call him today. He wrote a lot of books, which people could buy on subscription, very much like the old Enlightenment guys did. But he had no university post, and he didn't really have a job other than these kind of management seminars that he would run, sometimes out of his own house, where people, let's say, you know, minor nobility or people aspiring to rule would come and listen to him in these kind of seminar settings about how to run the world. So he had a bit of a cult following at the time. Now, Durkheim, when he went for the first chair in sociology in France, he had to basically dissociate himself from all that kind of stuff. Okay, and so part of what Durkheim did was to bring the argument a bit down to earth, because really Comte, and you know, Saint-Simon was interested in unifying Europe. Comte was interested in unifying the world. Okay, just like Marx, very much kind of like what Marx was doing. Durkheim had to bring the project back to earth and basically argued that this kind of intellectual project of positivism was in fact quite good as a way of providing a kind of moral basis for the secular nation-state of France. Okay, so here's the point that's quite important here, and it's one of the ways in which intellectuals were able to actually get some political traction in the second half of the 19th century, right? In the second half of the 19th century, the church gets taken out of education in a big way in Europe. It gets dispossessed of schools, okay? Which meant, especially in a period where the nation states are trying to consolidate their identities, what was going to be the source of, as it were, the guiding idea, right? What is going to keep us all unified? And this is in a period where people are worried about wars over national boundaries and resources and things like this. How do you keep the people together? So you're training all these people, but how do you keep them thinking that they're part of some kind of common project? So the project may not be the religion of humanity, but it may be, you know, the greater glory of France. Okay, and this is where Durkheim comes in, because his chair in sociology is founded in the School of Education. Right, and the kind of lecture courses that he gave when he was professor there were things on moral education. Okay, and what does that mean? And so a lot of the key concepts that you associate with Durkheim today, especially the ones having to do with deviance and anomie, and you know, if you've read his stuff on suicide, right, is all about the spiritual side of society and how it falls apart and how it gets put together. Well, that was the way he was able to sell this kind of intellectual positivism to a secular university system. In addition, another thing that Durkheim did, which is important for this, is Durkheim identified himself with the person who was probably the leading intellectual of his time in the way we understand the word intellectual today, as a kind of, you know, literary public figure. Emil Zola. Have you heard of Emil Zola, the novelist and critic? Emil Zola was very important in the 1890s in causing a lot of concern about the decision over Alfred Dreyfus, right? The Dreyfus affair, Captain Dreyfus, who was being basically scapegoated in a trial that he was selling secrets to the Germans. And so he got punished and sent off to Devil's Island, which was this French penal colony off of Guyana in South America. Well, Zola basically, through reading the transcripts and looking at other pieces of information, had concluded that Dreyfus was in fact being, was framed, was set up by the military, where the military basically was keen on reintroducing the monarchy to France. And what they were going to do was to highlight, what they did, part of what they did in the trial, was to highlight the fact that Dreyfus is Jewish. And with the end of the monarchy in France, it became possible for Jews to participate in public life and actually hold military positions, for example. So you had more, you had a lot of Jews all of a sudden entering into French public life after 1870, Dreyfus being one of them. Dreyfus gets scapegoated as some kind of spy. And so then this kind of raises the question, well, maybe this secular republic isn't such a great idea after all, because it lets in all these people who aren't loyal to the country, i.e. Jews. Okay. And so some of the most distinguished generals in France and so forth were testifying against Dreyfus. Zola basically went through the transcripts, looked at discrepancies in testimony, and basically wrote a very long long opinion piece in one of the major French papers, you know, with the famous title, J'accuse, right? I accuse you, the court, for covering this up and framing this poor man, right? Basically, as a political ploy to undermine the integrity of the Third Republic, okay? Durkheim and a lot of other academics, especially Jewish ones, right? Durkheim's Jewish. Wrote in support of Zola and wrote a collective letter. This was the first time this kind of thing had been done. I mean, it happens all the time now in newspapers. A bunch of intellectuals will get together and, you know, about all kinds of atrocities here, there, and everywhere. But this was a new thing. And Durkheim was very much part of that with Zola spearheading it. And they identified themselves as intellectuals because they were the people who were able to look at the evidence for themselves. So they read the transcripts of the trial and reached an opposite conclusion from that of the military tribunal, which tried Dreyfus. Right? So in other words, it's kind of, an enlightenment move in a way. And these people identified themselves officially as being, we're the intellectuals, this is what we think. Okay? And it put a kind of a gauntlet down. I mean, Zola was actually driven out of France. He was seen as, in fact, treasonous in what he was saying. He was undermining French efforts in various kinds of military and foreign affairs things. And so he got chased to England, and he was there for a while until things cooled down. But they eventually brought Dreyfus back to trial, and Dreyfus was vindicated. Okay. This was the first time, and Durkheim was very central to this, that the intellectuals did get identified as a class, kind of in the way we understand it today, you know, kind of literary people, academics, right, who will kind of organize themselves around an issue by writing a letter to the editor, right, that kind of, and you know, presenting, as it were, an independent standpoint that's different from the establishment standpoint. So that the Dreyfus affair, so we're talking, you know, 1898, it resolves itself, finally. And one of the things that Kurtzman says is that it's that moment that the political possibilities of an intellectual class transforming the world becomes clear. So it's no longer just, you know, Comte and Saint-Simon with their wild, crazy ideas, who are just talking to a few people, right? But rather, you're getting people who, as it were, have independent reputations. So Durkheim's a professor, Zola's a famous writer, right? Have independent reputations, but nevertheless identify as a class who can intervene in these matters. And this is what provides an inspiration, then, for people all over the world to think that they can transform their societies. Okay, so this is kind of where we get to the point where this book begins, the Kurtzman book. And it is interesting. I mean, one of the things that Kurtzman, you know, points out is that the kinds of things that these people were fighting for, by our standards, would seem to be quite modest, in the sense that none of these revolutions, these pro-democracy revolutions, were about women's suffrage, for example, which is kind of interesting. Okay, I mean, that wasn't one of the issues on the table. What was on the table was written constitutions, parliamentary democracy, you know, kind of a, in a way, very much a kind of intellectual's way of looking. Formal procedures for governance, okay, and a kind of depersonalization of politics, right? A more rational, organized form of political activity. And often the arguments that were made, you know, when you ask, well, what made these people so confident that things could be done? I mean, the example, when they talk about China, for example, the 1911 revolution, which we mentioned briefly last week, Kurtzman has a little discussion about this guy, Sun Yat-sen, who had some American training. And the thing that's kind of interesting about him is, why did he think a Republican revolution would work in China? Why did he think this, right? I mean, and so Kurtzman goes into this. And he's got very much this kind of positivist thing going on, okay? First thing he says is that, in a sense, there's first the issue of, in a way, the West has already made a lot of the mistakes that we can learn from. So there's that argument, right? So in a sense, you think about history as a collective learning process. So something that may have taken, whatever, 500 years to happen in the West can now take much less time in China because we don't have to start from where they started from. Okay? And in fact, he argued that that the fact that China, by his lights, did not have this strong tradition of disparities of wealth, especially in property owning, meant that China didn't inherit a lot of the problems that the West started with in order to get to the sort of modern point of view. This is his view. Moreover, when he was in the United States, he spent also some time in Hawaii, okay, which at that time was a colony of the United States, was an estate, was a colony. And he was very impressed by how these Hawaiians, who a couple of generations earlier were cannibals, were all of a sudden, very Americanized in the early 20th century already. And so he said, if you can take cannibals, two generations to turn cannibals into Americans, then it should take a lot less time for Chinese people to become Westernized. Now, you know, what do you make of someone who thinks like this? This is how Kurtzman represents his view, right? This, I think, is very strong. You know, there's clearly a kind of social evolution view going on here, right? Very Comtean thing. We've got the stages through which we go. We can learn from the past. It's like really a collective learning experience. It's like looking at history as if it were an intellectual project in a real clear way. You know, so he takes this idea of learning from the past very literally. Okay. By the way, his view is by no means unique, okay? That view of his is common to all these people who were these failed Democrats. And in fact, there is a whole thesis about this, which Kurtzman doesn't talk about. But I don't know, maybe if you study economic history, there's a famous Russian guy who's Russian by birth, but spent most of his career at Harvard, Gershenkron. Have you heard of this guy, Gershenkron? Gershenkron, there's a so-called Gershenkron thesis, which relates to this, which is the thesis, the relative advantage of backwardness. Right? And this is the idea that you don't have to, as it were, repeat all the mistakes that the people in the past made. So as a result, when you enter into, let's say, the market, or you enter into, you know, kind of modernity, you can do it a lot more quickly. Right? And so this thesis is quite a famous thesis. And one of the ways you sort of demonstrate the Gershengorod thesis is by saying, okay, how long did it take Britain to get to the Industrial Revolution from the beginning? It took a long time, but once Britain did it, France was able to do it in a shorter period of time, and after France did it, Germany was able to do it in a still shorter period of time. You see, and you can keep on going like that. Why? What's going on there? Well, supposedly, you understand that the people in the other countries who haven't yet progressed are learning from the progressive ones and not making their mistakes and starting from a different point. This is the thesis. Okay? Relative advantage of backwardness means you don't have to take the same amount of time or go through the same stages as the people in the past did. You can do it much more quickly in your own way. That's the thesis. And it's supposed to be a very optimistic thesis about modernization, because what it shows is first of all, it breaks away from a certain kind of stage-based thinking about modernization that you sometimes get in Marxist accounts, right? You think about Lenin, for example, right? So Lenin has the Soviet Revolution in 1917. Russia is still a predominantly agricultural country. There is relatively little industry in the country. Yet, if you're going to have socialism a la Marx, you've got to have strong industrial base that can then be socialized. So what does Lenin do? We get these five-year plans, right, which is to sort of fast-forward Russia from agriculture into industry, right? Well, the Gershengorod thesis thinks that this is a bit mad, okay? Because there's no reason to think that cultures have to reproduce the same stages in order to make it to where they got to go. There might be different routes, but you can learn from the others, but learning doesn't mean repeating. Okay? So this is the Gershengorod thesis. And this is something that you see a lot in evidence there, right? You can learn by not repeating. Do it your own way. Okay? The other thing here that I think is worth mentioning, because clearly, if you look at countries such as Germany, for example, where you actually do, you know, Germany, I think, during this period would have been regarded as the most intellectual country in the world. You know, and maybe even the strongest industrial power in the world. Germany did not have this situation. I mean, this is the interesting thing, right? Germany is a very intellectual country with a very strong university culture, very deliberately planned, Humboldt, all that stuff from the early 19th century, does not fall into this kind of analysis that we're talking about here. And that's an interesting story in its own right. Because one of the things here is that the Germans actually built up their university system and their intellectual class in conjunction with nation building, all done from the top down. So in other words, people like Saint-Simon and Comte existed outside of the mainstream of French society, and in fact were basically seen as radical, because French society, until 1870, was governed by the church and by a monarchy that kept on being reinstated. Okay? So there was this tension between the intellectuals developing and what was going on in the society. Germany, in a way, planted everything together at the start. So at the beginning of the 19th century, when Germany is basically responding to Napoleon and is trying to create a kind of strong nation state from scratch, they start to build national identity at the same time they build the universities. The two are built together. And so the intellectual class that comes from academia in Germany is seeded by the state. And the way you see this, you know, the legacy of this is the idea of academic freedom. Academic freedom. Academic freedom is a German invention. And academic freedom is the freedom that intellectuals have as a guild right. Okay, when we talk about a guild, right? We mean a right that you have by virtue of your occupation. Okay, academic freedom, as you know, is this ability to be able to lecture, you know, and research anything, basically, right? And you've got
as it were, immunity from any kind of negative consequences, because you were this free, intellectual, autonomous agent, right? Well, in Germany, we often think about this as just freedom of speech or something, right? In the English-speaking world, we tend to look at this in a very generic way. We tend to think about academic freedom as just a version of freedom of speech. But in fact, there was no freedom of speech in Germany. This is the point. There was no freedom of speech in Germany. So the idea that you had the freedom to speak was a protected right by virtue of your profession, guild right. Academic freedom was guild right. So in other words, you
have this kind of, might say, social contract between the intellectuals and the state that is established in the beginning of the 19th century in Germany, which is the conditions of academic freedom. Namely, that we will allow you to do whatever research you want, to speak your mind however you wish, but in return, you cannot undermine the state, because the state is the guarantor of your freedom. And nobody else in the society has this freedom but you, because the state allows you to have it. Okay? Now, this is in practice pretty tricky to maintain, and people did get into trouble. Okay? So, for example, Karl Marx got into trouble. Because, you know, a lot of the so-called young Hegelians, right? You may know about the so-called young Hegelians, these sort of second-generation followers of Hegel, Marx being one of them, who were questioning the foundations of Christianity. And, of course, Germany has established church at the time, Lutheran Church. Here's Marx and his pals basically undermining the theological conditions of this. So Marx was never allowed to teach in a university in Germany. And so, in fact, when he started publishing this stuff in a newspaper in Cologne, Germany, he was booted out and had to go to France. Okay, that's what happened to Karl Marx. So the point was that you were not just simply allowed in Germany to say whatever you wanted, even if it was academic. You had to be an academic to do it, and you had to watch the boundaries. You could not say anything that would undermine the authority of the state. So you could not undermine Christianity, for example, because the state had this Christian basis to it. Okay? So Marx got into trouble for that. But the interesting thing was that for the most part, what ended up happening was academic freedom became in Germany this highly jealously guarded, protected kind of thing that academics had, which allowed them a lot of space to move around as long as they kept it within academic boundaries. So what you started to get was actually quite a lot of interesting, innovative, radical things being said, but increasingly said to other academics. Okay? And, you know, so people were having revolutions in their own minds. You know, so in a way, it's kind of a... In a way, this is a bit what has happened to Marxism, in fact, right? Marxism today is a form of literary criticism, okay? And is practiced mostly by other academics for other academics in the West. I mean, it doesn't really have that much political impact in the West, really. But there's a lot of it going on in the universities, right, as a mode of interpretation. That's what Marxism is nowadays, right? Well, in a sense, that process was already happening in Germany in the 19th century, where a lot of this so-called critical, right, the critical discourses, right, of intellectual life that were so troublesome during the Enlightenment and kept people like Comte and Saint-Simon out of the mainstream in France, right, in Germany was becoming internalized and institutionalized in this kind of academic mode. Okay? And of course they made a lot of very brilliant intellectual moves in Germany. Germany is a country, of course, the foundation of most of the academic disciplines. There's no doubt about it that this move of bringing the intellectuals into the university system and nationalizing the whole thing had a lot of very positive benefits. But it certainly made it difficult, if not impossible, for any kind of major political revolution to happen in Germany. Okay? I mean, even, you know, Karl Marx predicted that the communist revolution would happen in Germany because it had the most developed labor force, and you had the most, you know, sophisticated, you know, literate intellectual population. Didn't happen. Okay? And so, I think there's that other story of what happened to the intellectuals in the 19th century, right? That's not told by Kurtzman, but it's kind of, in a sense, the intellectuals became academics, and the academics became increasingly insular. They did important things, but important things that were mainly of relevance to academics. Okay? And so that actually got rid of a lot of the revolutionary activity. I mean, I think, you know, the other place, you know, Germany is one example, but of course, in the 20th century, the United States would be the great example of a country with massive university structure, right, leading the world in almost every field, lots of intellectual stuff going on. No revolution ever happened. Lots of critical discourses being proliferated. No, if anything, what happens is that the revolutionary movements that exist outside the society, once they get into the universities, they sort of stop. Or they become internalized. And as you know, there's this whole, in the Western world generally, but especially in the United States, there is this ongoing debate about whatever happened to feminism. Whatever happened to feminism? Feminism is incredibly successful in the universities. The transformation of university power structure to include women governing things, that's in fact the sector of society where women have made the most inroads, universities. But the price has been, arguably, is that now feminism is an academic movement, a purely academic movement, which only academics understand. It doesn't really relate to regular women, especially, you know, younger ones. Right? So there's, and this is kind of the German phenomenon we're talking about here, is this kind of the way in which the intellectuals become institutionalized, and when they become institutionalized, they basically become part of the establishment. Okay. So this is a different kind of scenario about what happens to intellectuals. It does a lot for academic life, makes it very rich, very sophisticated, but it politically neutralizes them. And it's very, and what you need then is that then if you're going to have any kind of, you know, social movement or political movement, it's got to somehow get back out of the university. It's got to leave the university. Okay. Now, one of the ways in which, in fact, this kind of thing has happened, if you want to say, what's the formula? We may be entering into a period where it could happen. Because when the universities start to lose their funding, when the financial base falls apart, when, you know, when academics, in a way, no longer have a kind of protected space, when they have to make more explicit public justifications for what they're doing, those kinds of moves very often force people to make political moves they might not otherwise make. Okay, I mean, this does happen. So there may be something vaguely positive about the fact we're entering into this financial crisis of the universities, okay, in this part of the world, is that it might actually force people to be a little more political because they no longer can just continue to do things in a business as usual manner, okay. And I think one way to see this is if you follow any of the news stories that are going on now about the changes of the university, the focus on impact of research, the impact of teaching, and we have to somehow come up with ways of measuring it, okay? And this can lead to all kinds of interesting ways of thinking about what we're up to, okay? You know, of course, the government would like us to think in terms of economic impact, in terms of making the society more productive, but there are all other kinds of impact as well that could be argued, all right? So that's one way in which this sort of this business of being institutionalized as an intellectual can be challenged. I'm running out of gas here. I see. Okay, I'm going to have to stop this because my battery's been the thing that's been making the beeping sound you might have heard for the last couple of minutes. Okay, so all right. Yeah, no wonder I'm running out of tape, I'm running out of everything. Okay, let me just stop this.